Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. I'd like to welcome our special guest, Danny Donaghy. Danny works with world-class athletes and leaders to improve performance through greater presence. He has held several leadership positions in elite sports, most recently working with the leading Premiership soccer club in the UK. Danny brings his lifelong practice of meditation from Eastern traditions alongside a more psychologically informed approach to his work. So Danny, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas podcast. How are you doing today?
Hi, Simon. Thanks. It's really great to be here. I'm really good. It's an honor to be here. You know, some of the past guests you've had on have been incredible, and your work as well has inspired me. It helped me get through my dissertation at the Tavistock. So it's a real honor to be here.
That's good to hear. Good to hear that I'm influencing the Tavistock master's degrees again. It was a long time ago when I taught there and studied there. Did you enjoy your studies? Just for listeners to know that the Tavistock master's degree I taught on and Dan is referring to is one where we think about how psychoanalysis impacts on organizations. Did you enjoy your study there, Danny?
Enjoy might not be the right word. So it's quite an interesting story. So I've spent most of my life working in football, and I got interested in the unconscious at quite a young age. And so things kind of moved on, and I heard about this master's course at the Tab. Well, actually, I was on another master's course at Metanoia. Mm-hmm. And Eliat Aram, she came in and did a day with us, and she just blew me away. Her way of being and the way she spoke and her presence and also the content of that day was incredible. So I knew that she worked at the Tavistock, and I had no idea that the Tavistock Institute was separate from the Tavistock in Portman where the master's was. So I found out that there was a master's, and I thought, right, I've got to do it. So I went to the interview knowing nothing about the Tavistock or what it was, or even psychoanalysis. And the interview was, it was a group interview, and there was two facilitators. And basically they said to the group of 12 people, we want you to devise an interview for this course. And then they left us to it for 90 minutes. And the two facilitators just sat there not saying a word. I'm asking them questions. They're not answering my questions. And it was chaos in the group. So I left this interview. I went for a one-on-one interview, and that was equally bizarre, you know, totally different from the world I'd come from. So I left the Tavistock building, and I felt like I would never go back there for the rest of my life. You know, that the rest of my life wouldn't be long enough to go back there. And I went home and I went to sleep. I woke up in the morning and I thought, yeah, I've got to do it. So something happened in the sleep, and my relationship with the Tavistock over the 2 years of that course has been the same. You know, it's a real love-hate relationship.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar to a lot of people. The work you've been doing in football, you work with really top-class athletes, don't you? Like professional footballers in the Premier League, you've been working for a long time. Do you want to say something about that work, and we'll return to kind of how the Tavistock work influences or not that kind of work? Do you want to say something about kind of working with top athletes? This is what kind of interested me, right? How you bring this stuff together? This kind of what's your actual job in the football clubs you work in, Danny?
Well, I'm currently not working for a football club, but until recently, I was director of medical services. And originally I was a physiotherapist, so I come from that background, and football's grown so much over the years that I became a leader of the medical services, which is a big field. You know, across the club, there's probably 30 or 40 people, okay, all kind of different professions, physios, osteopaths, doctors, sports scientists. So that was my leadership role. And when I was at the Tavistock, that kind of helped me in the leadership role to understand the dynamics of the organization and how I can become a better leader. And now my work is with athletes and business people, helping them understand themselves better and leadership and how they can improve their performance. And even in my leadership role in football, I did work one-on-one with athletes, you know, throughout my career. And that was in a number of different ways.
Yeah. So what interests me, a question I have is, at the Tavistock, their way of thinking beyond Wilfred Bion and that kind of work was very much about group as a whole and basic assumptions of how group culture has impact on our individual selves. Were you able to kind of bring that way of thinking into your work with footballers?
Yeah, I think more than anything, it helped me understand being in the organization myself a lot better. And it helped me understand how the group as a whole responds to a change in the structure, a change in the manager. And then also, you know, there's so many things that have changed in football recently. One example is that in the UK, they've brought in a director of football. And that means that the director of football has a more longer-term vision and strategy for the club. And the manager has more short-term vision and kind of power over the players. And that's really changed the whole dynamic of the game, because 10 years ago, the manager had all the power in the organization and the players and all of the staff followed the manager religiously. It was as Bjorn would say, it was a dependency group, a high dependency group. And now it's changed because that power has been kind of diluted for the manager. So it makes it a lot more difficult for the managers to be effective, I think. And I'm not convinced that it's empowering the players and empowering the staff. It feels like it's just a shift of power and not in a good way.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. So your Brian Clough and your Fergusons would struggle in this new setup. They'd be very different kind of levels of power and influence in the clubs.
Yeah, I think it would be impossible for Alex Ferguson to have had the same success and the same impact in a club in this current setup. And I worked with David Moyes at Everton for 12 years, and that was before a director of football, and he had complete power. But luckily, he had more of a long-term vision and more of a strategy for the welfare of the club and the people within it. Whereas now it feels like the managers, because they're short-term, they don't have that longer vision. And that creates a whole lot of pressure and projection down in the organization. So in my role as director of medical, it was the most important thing was to kind of look after the welfare of the players. And I felt like years ago that the whole club was aligned to that mm-hmm. want. Whereas now, it feels like the pressure cascades down, because all of the clubs that have billionaire owners and the pressure really is to perform and to win rather than kind of the welfare of the organization. So it's a real shift.
Yeah, no, that is a big shift. And it's interesting that it's like I do a huge amount of work in business, and I work in global banks and engineering companies and car manufacturers and all sorts. And there's that kind of shift there as well, that drive for kind of short-termism, that drive for kind of short-term success and short-term kind of benefit for the shareholders stops a kind of a longer-term vision, stops a longer-term kind of a strategy, which in the end kind of undermines them. It's like the short-term success undermines a kind of a longer-term, and undermining the welfare of the workers, trying to get maximum production out of the workers, actually kind of undermine the longer-term kind of success of the organization. It's a paradox, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, and it seems that at the moment in football, there's fewer and fewer organizations who are getting it right. And I think even the structure, you know, getting back to the Tavistock, they look at the psychodynamics and also the systemic factors. The structures in a lot of these organizations isn't well set out. And I think that obviously reflects the ownership and the way maybe the owners have come into the game and what that means for the game. Yeah. And then I think also you've got the bottom down impacts as well. So I was reading your paper on the happiness imperative last night before this podcast. And I can relate to that a lot in football, because I see a lot of players who suffer from depression, and they, you know, there's this imperative that they should feel happy because mm-hmm. they've got everything you could ever want in terms of finances. They're doing a job that from the outside looks, you know, interesting and exciting and something you should enjoy. And I feel like players are in a real difficult position, because if they don't enjoy it, that they feel guilty, and it's very difficult to have anyone to be able to express that to, because a lot of people wouldn't understand the fact that they're in this seemingly perfect situation from the outside and they're not happy.
Sure. No, I get that. And I mean, that paper I wrote, that short essay, was really talking about how we live in a society of commanded enjoyment, that in the 1950s, it was a society of prohibition where people would, you were told, no, know your place. You know, there was a downside to that as well. It was kind of there's a limiting side of it. But now it's like, unless you're happy, you're failing yourself, you're failing your family, you're not living to your full self. And it's a huge pressure on everybody. And like you're saying, footballers who kind of seemingly have everything, it's almost an impossible kind of position to be in. And of course, we know that this positive psychology and kind of happiness imperative actually undermines happiness in America, where it's like at its highest, this kind of happiness imperative, there's the highest levels of depression and kind of medication. And because everyone has to hide their anxieties, their concerns, their shadow side.
Yeah, I think for a footballer especially, you know, as I said, from the outside, it looks like an easy thing to do. And I've always been in touch, because my dad was a footballer. I was a footballer briefly. And obviously I've worked with him for so long. I've really known that it's a very difficult thing to do. You know, every day they have to compete. They're competing with each other. There's 11 places in the starting lineup, and it's a fierce competition every day of their lives.
Yeah.
And also, you know, thinking about the Tavistock and Menzies life, how there's social defenses against the anxieties that come up. I feel like in football, that there's loads of those defenses that have come now. And a lot of that is about, you know, the managers and the systems trying to control the players. So they have very little control over their lives. Most of the time they're working 7 days a week. They have to eat at a certain time. They're told what they have to eat. Everything is done for them. And, you know, there's not a lot of room for creativity or freedom or even like a sense of identity other than being a footballer. And it's a real difficult life in many ways.
Yeah, it's a tough gig. I mean, the other passion I have is cycling, and watching the lives of professional cyclists. It's a kind of similar thing. The regime, the diet, the kind of it's absolutely kind of controlled by science and technology, and kind of what you can eat, what you can't eat, kind of how much training you do. And it's like you say, you're sense of identity and your individualness is kind of squeezed to the very limits, really. I think any professional sports person these days goes through that kind of regime, which is very tough, actually.
Yeah, and I think, you know, lots of the things that they do are important. But for me, like I said, it feels like it's a psychological defense. So a lot of it, you know, like the detail that they go into with the nutrition and the demands that they make on them, like the weekly schedule is often focused around eating. So they have to eat breakfast at this time, they have to eat lunch at this time, they have to eat this, and they have to take these supplements. And for my mind, it doesn't really make a big difference. You know, if you eat a normal, healthy diet, you're going to be fine. And it's an attempt at a psychological defense to make the players have kind of comfort that they're doing everything they can to make sure that they're going to maximize their potential as a player. Another example is recovery. So, you know, there's a huge raft of things that players have to do after a game to make them feel like they've recovered for the next game. And most of it, there's no scientific evidence to support it. Again, I feel like it's just a psychological defense to make them have this sense that they're doing everything they can.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that's very interesting. I mean, for listeners, again, Menzies Lies wrote about nursing and the social defenses of against anxiety that nurses face when they're working with death and they're working with illness. And as a nurse myself, a general and a psychiatric nurse, I witnessed that very clearly, you know, that you put your uniform on and you didn't actually get, you weren't encouraged to get emotionally involved with patients. And I got told off quite often for getting emotionally involved. I was always told off for Nurse Western, stop sitting on the bed and talking to the patients, do some work. And I'm like, this is the work. This patient's dying and they need someone to talk to, you know. It's like, you know, I was in the psychological frame. But those, I mean, one thing social defenses do is very much about kind of give you the imagination that you're in control of your environment. And that's kind of what you're expressing, really, to think that you can be in complete control of the environment around you, that you're kind of ticking every box to be successful. And like you say, it's actually an imaginary kind of position rather than kind of a real position.
I can relate to what you were saying about being on the bed with the player, because in football, injury is similar to death. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have an injury and it can end your career. So yeah, it's a huge fear. And I found myself over the years many times being in that position with a player who kind of felt like his career was ending. And I actually experienced it myself as a player. Yeah. So there's all kinds of anxieties and emotions that come up in that moment. And like you, I felt like, you know, it was an honor to be there to kind of connect emotionally with the players in those times of death.
Yeah, yeah, that's very interesting. The other thing with leadership, you know, I write and work with leaders all the time. And from psychoanalysis, we talk about projections and interjections, like how leaders get projected good things and bad things onto them, football managers, football players. To be a football player and to walk out into a stadium and have 50,000 people adoring you or hating you, how did you experience that? How did they kind of manage that, these young men, often kind of without much equipment, psychological equipment to deal with that? How do they deal with that kind of huge amount of projections of love and often hatred?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. And definitely in recent times, because of social media, it's increased tenfold. So, you know, when a player comes off the pitch, they, even if they don't look at social media, they've got friends who are telling them everything that's happening anyway. Yeah. So you can't avoid it. And I think it's really difficult, and it's difficult to kind of support them through that. One of the things I found is that in football, especially, they're resistant to psychology and psychologists. And I think the reason is because it's very difficult as a footballer to own and admit that they're having mental health issues. Mm. And I think that the main reason is that if you do that, then it's going to threaten your position. A future team might not sign you if they know you've got mental health issues, just like they might not sign you if you've got injury issues. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult as a player to reach out for help. And I felt like in my role, because I'd done all this studying, they could kind of work with me in a way that wasn't seen and wasn't known, you know, in terms of like working with a psychologist officially. And then there's the confidentiality, which is really important. So, yeah, to answer your question, it's really difficult for them to deal with that the projections of love and hate. And, you know, I work with managers and coaches as well. And for them, it's equally, if not even more difficult, because they've got those projections of love and hate from the fans, but also from the players and from the board above. And, you know, I've worked with managers who they get the positive projections and they get carried away with those. And then equally they get the negative projections, and it's very difficult to get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I kind of write a lot about this and say that, you know, one of the great leadership skills is be able to manage these projections and not be seduced by the positive ones and not get carried away and not be kind of killed off or destroyed by the negative ones, you know, to manage yourself and realize it's not all about you. But it's a huge, kind of, I mean, to do that kind of work, you need like supervision, a coach, a psychologist, somebody to support you in that. I mean, in our world, we kind of know, you know, I do coaching and I have supervision to support me. So when I go into a big company, you know, I get projections of many things and, you know, you have to deal with them, as do the leaders. So that's why I offer coaching to the leaders. I'm surprised there's still this resistance to kind of a psychologist. I was really shocked. I read that the Manchester United new manager was bringing in a psychologist to Man United and I'm like, what, they don't already have one? They spend so much time on this diet, these social defenses on diet and kind of, and you know, millions and millions they spend on kind of different aspects, and yet they won't have a kind of the most basic kind of thing, which is a psychologist or a coach or a supervisor to help manage these kind of emotions.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it, that I think what I was saying about, you know, it being perceived as a weakness and difficult to express as a player, I think that prevents it. And then also it's interesting, as you notice, that the manager brought in the psychologist himself. Yeah. So that in itself is going to have a huge impact on the role of that psychologist and how that works within the club. I've got an interesting story about that. It was quite a long time ago in one of the clubs I was working. And basically, we were kind of struggling at the time, and we had a few older players who were coming to the end of their contracts. So at the start of the season, the manager brought in a psychologist, and the psychologist spoke to the players and said that it's completely confidential, the work that we're going to do. And basically, the players expressed their distaste for the manager and their unhappiness about not having longer contracts and the fact that they felt insecure about that. So the session ended and the psychologist walked out and he went into another room and the manager was in the other room and the psychologist proceeded to tell the manager everything that the players had said. And one of the players actually saw this and heard what he was saying. So he then went and let all the players know. But it was really interesting what happened then, because the players kind of went into fight or flight mode and combined as a group in their anger towards the manager, and it actually fueled them to great success. And it was probably the most successful season we ever had. So I don't think the psychologist did that work consciously, but he did some amazing work in that session.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. With the Tavistock mode of working, they always try and move people out of fight-flight mode and into dependency mode, as we call it. To try and into kind of mature way of working, which is the depressive position from client. And it's kind of interesting, because when I work in entrepreneurial businesses or fast moving businesses, you know, you actually need some fight flight as well. It's interesting. And what you've just described is kind of a working use of fight flight, where you channel it into the game and you do well.
Yeah, well, I think Bjorn spoke about there being particular cases, didn't he, where, you know, like the church and the army was a real need for fight or flight. And football really it's a battle, isn't it? It's a physical battle. So I think fight or flight is a huge imperative for football managers to use in the right way, but obviously not to overuse it. And I think that, you know, there's dependency, which has always been quite high in football. So I spent some time with the England rugby team a couple of years ago, and I was blown away by the empowerment that the players had. So that the rugby players would take a lot of the team meetings, they do a lot of analysis of the other teams. Whereas in football, quite often, the manager will stand there, he'll tell you the tactics, and he'll ask you if you want to say anything, and the players just will sit there and not say a word. So there's that real dependency that still lingers in football.
Yeah, no, that is interesting, the difference. I mean, I grew up in Bristol, and I was a passionate rugby player, and I played for Bristol and went on to have a trials for England as a youth. It's interesting, the different cultures, like between kind of soccer and rugby and other sports, and kind of how some do enable kind of the players to have more autonomy. I mean, it's very interesting when you think about the amount of money pumped into football and the amount of money depending on success in football, and that these kind of basic building blocks people get wrong. You know, we know that kind of human beings generally kind of aren't motivated unless you have some form of autonomy, some sort of control of their lives and some sort of say in what's happening. And yet what you're describing is the opposite.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. Although when the players actually get onto the field, then of course they have complete autonomy. But the other thing that I find in football that's interesting is that I was working with a player this week, and he said that 10 years ago, he had a real sense of unity in the team, and he took a lot of joy from working as part of a team. Whereas now it's a lot more individualized, and players now even have their own teams around them. So they've created their own sense of team away from the team. And I think it's something that's really missing in the game now, and they've lost that. You know, my dad played in the 70s, and he's still great friends with all of the players that he played with at that time, as am I. And that kind of sense of team unity and togetherness and friendship, it's kind of gone missing. And yeah, I think that's part of the cascade that I spoke about.
I think that that's very important. And I think you even notice it kind of as a fan. It's sort of I'm a Bristol Rovers fan, and I grew up in Bristol, and you know, there was a real camaraderie around the whole, you know, the fans, the players, everybody kind of did feel a kind of a whole. Whereas if you go and support kind of one of the top clubs now with players who are coming and going, and it's so kind of fragmented, isn't it? That there's such a kind of speed of change that it's almost like you have to look after yourself and get a small group to support yourself, because there's not that kind of a stability or kind of a longer termism.
Yeah, I also thought about in terms of social defence, you know, Menzies Lyth with the nurses, she spoke about how they didn't stay with the patient, so they didn't create that bond with them, and nurses weren't named, they had numbers and things like that. And I wondered whether in football there's the defence of players not staying at a club and not having a real affinity with a club, so they don't have that bond that, you know, to create that emotional bond. I think that's another social defense.
Yeah. And I'm sure you're right. Another of your interests, Danny, is meditation. Do you want to say something about kind of that and how that impacts on your work?
Yeah. So this is, well, I found it difficult at Tavistock at first to kind of take on the ideas, because it's quite different from what I'd kind of been used to. You know, I've been on like loads and loads of silent retreats and meditation practices. And I noticed in your article about happiness that you mentioned that, you know, you can do mindfulness and you'll be happy. And mindfulness has been a practice of mine since I was 18. So for over 30 years. And I got it from my dad. So my dad was a footballer in the 70s, and he meditated every day. So I obviously took that practice and way of being from him. So I started meditating when I was 18, and I've practiced with many kind of teachers and different methods over the years. And it's given me a lot of happiness, actually. but I kind of take your point about happiness, because meditation and mindfulness is about, for me anyway, it's about fully being in the moment. And that means embracing whatever's there. So it's not about this artificial generation of happiness. It's about being fully in tune with whatever emotion is there and living that fully. So, you know, if you feel sad, then feel the sadness rather than repressing it. So it kind of goes hand in hand with the Tavistock in some ways. And what I find with players now, and also leaders, is that they've kind of lost contact with their body and the present moment. They spend a lot of time in their head and ideas, and just helping them come into that presence in the present moment really helps them kind of engage with being who they are more fully, and kind of being a stronger and more powerful leader in whatever way that may be.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, I critique mindfulness sometimes because of the way I see it used in organizations. It's kind of used instrumentally. It's the organization yeah. give it to people to make them more productive, basically.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's used kind of in a very wrong way, you know, and yeah. it's not about embracing kind of your body. It's about de-stress yourself and you'll be a better worker, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand.
So it's used in a way. But that's your dad must. Where did your dad get meditation from? I mean, was he a child of the 60s? Was he?
I've said this before on a podcast, and I got in trouble, but I'll say it again. So when he was 16, 17, he grew up in the Gorbals in Glasgow, which was a real tough place to grow up.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of experimentation with LSD at the time. And he was desperate to be a footballer, so he didn't really do it. But he had one experience with LSD. And he said that it completely opened his mind and changed his perception. And from that moment, it made him kind of desire to know himself and to know what that feeling was. So that led to that kind of inquest, you know, and yeah. inquiry into who am I and what is this experience I had. So from, I think, being 19, 20, he learned transcendental meditation.
Okay.
He did that all the time. And he still does it today. And he's actually a teacher.
Wow.
So it had a huge impact on me. And he used to... When I was young, like, you know, 4 or 5, used to get my sister and I to sit in meditation posture and just get in touch with your body and ask, who am I? And those kind of things. And at the time we kind of had a laugh and thought it was a joke. But I'm quite grateful for that now.
Yeah, no, it's very powerful. And it's interesting you say about LSD because the use of the natural form of LSD from mushrooms and stuff, it is now coming very much back into medicine and people are using it to look at depression and many things. It's becoming, it does clearly kind of have an impact on human beings. We've been kind of for hundreds and hundreds of years, different kind of indigenous peoples have been using these methods and to open up our minds. It's interesting that it's come back as a very strong interest in science today. So, Yeah.
I think there's huge potential and it's going to be tapped in more. But I do also think, you know, your point about mindfulness and how it's kind of used in the wrong way. I feel like now a lot of people say go off to Peru for an ayahuasca retreat and they have these kind of highs, but it's not integrated into their lives. And I think that's a mistake as well, because then you're always kind of chasing the next high and it's not making your life richer and it's not kind of tuning you into your natural essence. So I think it needs to work hand in hand with other modalities to have a real impact.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's kind of a fetish or kind of romanticism about going to somewhere exotic and taking this magical cure and changing your life. And it's not doing the real work, is it? It's flight, really. It's, I mean, I'm actually a Quaker as well. I don't meditate, but I'm a Quaker, and sitting in silence is part of my practice. And it's that being still, that stillness, that being in your body is just so important to me in my work, you know, and the work I do. So kind of we share that. And I think what's interesting about the psychoanalytic community and the Tavistock and stuff, they actually sit in many groups in silence, and when I went there, it was very interesting because my first experience was, wow, this is just like a Quaker meeting. It's like you're sat in a small group, you're sat in a circle. In Quaker meetings, they talk about the spirit speaking through you, and in the Tavistock, they talk about the unconscious speaking through you. And I thought this is, and then I read a lot about John Rickman, who was Beyond's partner in developing all these methods. And he was a Quaker. So I could really see that he'd learned from his Quakerism and brought it into kind of a secular society and using some of the similar kind of parallel methods.
I'm interested in that. I'm interested in Quakers. I've spent a little bit of time in their buildings and there's a real kind of energy and presence in those buildings that has obviously been built up through their practices. But you mentioned about spirit speaking through you and then unconscious speaking through you. What sense do you make of that? Because for me, that they kind of have different qualities. The spirit has a different quality to the unconscious. And what sense do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I agree. Although I think there's I think one can inform the other as well. So I think if we open ourselves up to experience, to our full experience, which includes the spirit and the unconscious, then I think they tell us something and can lead us in, you know, in Quakers, we talk about being led by the spirit. You know, but sometimes that means being having a heightened awareness of kind of like your unconscious desires or your resistances or your anxieties. You know, if you have an awareness of that, then it can allow you to be more open to spirit, I think, because otherwise we can defend ourselves against these kind of and these things are difficult to talk about. I mean, whenever I try and talk about theology or religion or faith or spirit, then I always find words aren't enough, because it's beyond words. It's true. The whole point is beyond words, you know. But you know, I do think there's a connection there, and in some group relations meetings we've been to, we've actually worked with kind of both, you know, both spirit and the unconscious, and trying to kind of get in touch with that. It's difficult, and there's huge defenses in secularism, you know, in psychoanalytic communities who want to be scientific and secular, and as I said, there's huge defenses against the spirit and the. And it's difficult to work in those communities.
Yeah, I've found when I started at the Tavistock a resistance in myself towards it, because I feel like I was quite familiar with spirit. And, you know, for example, in the experiential groups at the Tavistock, for me, I had a certain idea of what an experiential group meant for me. And I guess it was kind of more around presence and being and spirit. And in the Tavistock, it was kind of more intellectual and about thoughts and ideas. And I had a real resistance to that at first. But like you say, I kind of feel like the marriage of both is really powerful. And to become aware of your own patterns psychologically and the patterns of the people you're working with, and then blend that with presence and blend that with spirit is a really powerful and it kind of, it's more holistic,
yeah.
Properly holistic.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Bion himself went on a journey into the spiritual kind of transcendental kind of side of stuff in his later work, as many others have. I mean, it's interesting how different groups segment this, you know. So you have different groups in religion or faith or psychoanalysis and how much we do compartmentalize rather than try and look at this holistic kind of experience of being human in this world, being human with other animals on the planet, with nature. I think modernity has made us all very compartmentalized. That's what modernity does. It divides us into it categorizes people, it categorizes things, it divides, you know, and I think we have that mindset. And I think working like with meditation or with faith and spirit, you're trying to kind of move towards a more interconnected and interdependence. That's my experience.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I also, you know, working with people, my sense is that people are really craving this connection and this interdependence that you speak of. And if you know, through the work, if you can help them connect with their presence and their spirit and their full sense of being who they are, it's a huge gift that you can give to people. And that's why I enjoy working with people in this way, you know, in this deep way. You know, for the listeners now, for us, if they can just connect with their sense of presence now in this moment when they're listening to this, it changes your experience of the world and the moment. And the more presence that you can bring into your life, the more that you have that sense of interconnectedness, because the boundaries that we create in our mind are no longer there in presence and in spirit. We're all interconnected, and you naturally want to care for other people as you care for yourself. So it's a real rich way of thinking and working. And it makes me think about, you know, the systemic practice as well, that it kind of is brought in at the Tavistock. And I feel like that's really rich work and something that I'm learning more about and practicing as well.
Yeah, and in analytic network coaching, we work with this. So in my coaching book, I talk about soul guide coaching and I link coaching back to kind of shamanism and counseling and therapy and spiritual direction. All these were one-to-one helping relationships, you know, and coaching is kind of a late manifestation of that. So we begin our training we have five frames of working. We work with depth analysis. I don't ever push meditation or spirituality, but I say, you know, if you go with a client and you forget targets, you forget goals, you just create a space and you create a holding space and a containing space, and you allow the client to open up, work with what comes, you know, work with, yeah, work with being present. And it's actually very hard because, you know, coaches say, they come in and they say, well, my client would do that. They're busy. They're professionals. I'm there to help them. I'm like, you know, I said, let them breathe first. You know, breathe first and see where this goes. You know, and I just hold that space. And it's incredibly powerful and it changes everything. And then, you know, later on in our training, we work very much with network analysis, systemic thinking, how you can influence the networks and society around us and how they influence you. And actually, it goes back to that depth analysis. Like you say, it's like if you start there and you open yourself up, you start feeling it interconnected and you can then do the later work. So this systemic work and this deep interpersonal work is they're very linked and connected.
Yeah, definitely. When you were speaking, for some reason, I remembered about my dream. So one thing that helped me get through the Tavistock was dreams. For example, when I first learned about Melanie Klein's theory about good breast and bad breast and psychological splitting, intellectually, I kind of thought I wasn't having it at all. I was thinking, this is absolute nonsense. How can somebody know that a baby is doing this psychologically? So I'd go home and I'd have a dream that night that would show me the truth of the theory. And it was incredible what happened. So that kind of kept me in touch with the theory. And obviously, like, there's huge richness and there's definitely some truth in those theories. And you can see the splitting now in society. Yeah. But I thought last night before this podcast, I would see if a dream might come just to kind of prepare me for the podcast or to give me some insight. And the good news is I had a dream, but the bad news is it was my typical anxiety dream. So throughout my life, I've had a dream that I'm about to go onto a football pitch and then I can't find my boots, or my boots don't have studs, or I'm naked, I don't have my kit, anything like that. But last night, my dream was I was actually at the stadium. I wasn't playing, so that was a relief. But I had a baby as well. I was looking after a baby. And this baby kind of had the devil in it. You know, it was a devilish baby and it was very difficult to kind of contain and look after. So I had the double anxiety of the football stadium and the baby. So what does that mean?
Interpret that. I'm going to let the audience interpret that. I think I'm not going to interpret your dream live on air, but Danny, listen, this has been fascinating talking to you. I end my podcast, as you probably know, with a question about what thoughts you might have about what it means to live a good life and to create the good society. Do you have any kind of reflections for our listeners on what that might mean?
Yeah, I think it was Socrates who said an unexamined life is not worth living. Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout my experiences at the Tavistock, my life of meditation, and I think we've spoken about the unconscious spirit and interconnectedness of all. A full life is a life where you fully experience all of these modalities and all of these things to kind of examine yourself more fully.
Good. That's very rich. And I've really enjoyed this podcast. Danny, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your stories.
Thanks, Simon. It's been an honor.
If you are interested in joining our next Analytic Network Advanced Coach Training online, or would like to join our ongoing community of practice and attend our annual webinar series, please drop me an email, simon@analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. We'd also like to thank our sponsoring organization, the Eco Leadership Institute. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear more about related events, our coach and leadership training, or our webinars, contact Simon at analyticnetwork.com. www.eco-leadership.com or go to www.eco-leadership.institute. Thank you for listening.